This Week in Radio Tech, episode 202, is brought to you by Axia Audio and Telos Systems, together bringing IP audio studios and connections within your reach for superb audio and easy configuration, on the web at telosalliance.com. Often there's more than one way to solve an engineering problem, the normal approach followed by one or more hacks. Some hacks are elegant, while others, not so much. Chris Tobin and Kirk Harnack discuss radio engineering hacks, unusual but effective ways to fix and use broadcast equipment. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and really glad you're here. Today, we got an interesting show for you. A little different subject matter. Kind of a light show, kind of lighthearted. And you know what? We're going to watch the chat room and see if you have something to chime in with as well. By the way, if you're listening to this show right now, This Week in Radio Tech, if you're listening by means of a recorded podcast, in other words, if you've downloaded it, if you're watching it not live, let me encourage you to participate live. We do the show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursdays. That's 1900 UTC. At least it is right now. I guess that changes when daylight saving comes along. So, if you participate live, you can be in our chat room. If you go to gfqlive.tv, it'll pop up a chat room there, and you can participate right in there. You can be anonymous, or you can say who you are, or use somebody else's name if you like. Yeah. So, this is show number 202. I'm Kirk Harnack, and thank goodness I'm not alone. We have with us Chris Tobin, the best-dressed engineer in radio. Welcome in, Chris.
Why, thank you, Kirk. Yes, we're not alone, and hopefully we'll have our guests come by shortly. If not, it's just you and I, and we'll have a good time.
Good deal. Hey, tell us what you're doing nowadays. I used to introduce you all the time as from CBS, and then I introduced you as being from president of MusicCam USA, and you are probably have found a niche where you're just doing a lot of people a lot of good right now. Tell us about that.
What I basically am doing is I started a solutions company. I guess it's the way to call it. It's for people who create content, and I'm offering up solutions both over analog, digital, IP, my experiences in both broadcasting TV and radio, and a lot of internet stuff I've done over the years. And I'm still working with the folks at MusicCam as getting their stuff out, and that's part of the IP side of things. But I work with all the products, including the Telos Zip and the Comrex Access, TiLine, and help people build facilities and transmitter sites. And I just recently worked with a guy who just put together a complete STL system for six radio stations using three different IP radio links and dozens of IP codecs. And the best part was, he was like, wow, I'm glad I spent all this money. And I said, why? He goes, those cheaper versions that you told me I definitely have a problem with, it happened during a storm. I was like, oh, there you go. You get what you pay for. Huh.
So, let's talk about this for a second. Let me finish the introductions. Our show is brought to you by, happens to be my employer, and I appreciate them sponsoring the show, and that is the Telos Alliance. And I'll tell you about some changes of the Telos Alliance in terms of our public facing side that are very nice, and they're going to be very helpful to you. If you're a broadcast engineer or someone interested in engineering, you're going to like the changes coming up, and I'll tell you about those in just a few minutes. This is our 202nd episode, and delighted to be here with Andrew Zarian and the GFQ Network. This is the show where we talk about radio technology, everything from the microphone to the antenna at the top of the tower, that being the traditional radio, but now there are lots of digital distribution methods as well, and we talk about those too. Today's subject, the title of today's show, is Engineering Hacks. Engineering hacks. What have you as an engineer done? What have you had to do in order to solve a problem that was inscrutable? And maybe you found a good way to do it. Maybe you found a hack. And we didn't always used to call them hacks. We called them tips and tricks and things like that. And now hack is the in vogue word. So, Chris Tobin, do you have the opportunity to open the chat room?
Yes, I do.
Because maybe I need to... maybe I need to get a different chat client, but I'm not getting it to functionate for me very well. Oh, wait a minute. There it is. Just popped up. Okay, good deal. So we're in the chat room now. If you want to join the chat room, go to GFQ Network or gfqlive.tv, and you can see the chat room there. Andrew Zarian, maybe you can tell us another way to join the chat room and participate in the shows on the GFQ Network.
If you have an IRC client, you could put in irc.gfqnetwork.com in your IRC client, and the chat is GFQ Network.
Ah, okay. GFQ Network. Good deal. Let's see. All right. Well, so Engineering Hacks, and I was talking with Chris Tobin, our other co-host. And by the way, I should also mention, we have a scheduled guest. It's Dave Suplee with Cumulus Media. And I've known Dave for years and years. He builds lots of studios for Cumulus. He's like their go-to guy to put a studio together when they need to build a new one or refurbish one. And he got called away at the last minute to go to a transmitter site. He's trying to join us from the transmitter site now, but I'm not sure he's going to be able to if the coverage or internet connection out there is going to be good enough for him. If he's not here today, want to have him back on another show, maybe from one of the studios that he's built, because Dave's a great guy to talk to and understand his studio hacks. He's going to give us some good information about that and what he's had to do to get things on the air. And Chris Tarr, Chris Tobin, one of them may join us a little bit later in the show. We'll see. But right now, Chris Tarr and Tom Ray. Chris Tobin's with us now, and so let's get started with Engineering Hacks. We were talking with Chris Tobin about what he's doing now, and Chris, I think what you're doing here, if I understand it right, is something that's really necessary in today's world. We're dealing with some new technologies that not all the information is so easily available, or it's not part of our engineering tribal knowledge or our experience yet. And so you help people get digital or IP solutions, especially working for them. And so give us some examples of what you're doing for folks.
Well, let's see. Recently, an STL setup we did was with 5.8 gigahertz unlicensed radio links in their particular location where they are. They can get away with it. The distance between the studio and the transmitter facility is just under 2 miles. So we overbuilt the link budget, which is the power level of the signal between the two antennas. And it was enough to cover any rain fade, as well as probably any interference. And one of the things I did was working with them, explained to the customer, if you buy, now remember this phrase, because I tell this to everybody, you get what you pay for, okay? There is a cost to doing things the right way. There is a cost to ensuring what we all understand or used to understand is five nines of reliability, or the ability to be up and running, always on, to meet your needs. So if you're a radio station, television station, or maybe you're an internet content provider that has the need to be always there for your customers or your listeners, your viewers, whatever you want to call them, there mm-hmm. is a price to pay. So what I'm about to explain comes with a price. Because there would be people in the listening and watching this right now and say, oh my goodness, you do that, that's going to cost you X. Yes, it does. But on the flip side, the results you get is what you need. So this 5.8 gigahertz link, traditionally most people get two radios, they're transceivers, so they both transmit receive, create a link, and it's two antennas point to point, or a single antenna on each end. However, in recent years, because of the congestion and just overall RF in the world, if we could see RF signals, we wouldn't be able to walk the streets.
You're so right. What if we could?
It's true.
Yeah.
Take a spectrum analyzer, put a piece of wire on it, and look at the spectrum.
Yes. It's crazy. Right.
So what I've been doing with folks, and I've done this for many years, but now it's become vogue. 5 years ago, everybody laughed at you for doing it. I am buying antenna systems and designing it with dual polarization. So now what you have is the popular term nowadays is MIMO, multiple in, multiple out antenna designs. And you'll see that in your cell phone has a MIMO antenna system. And by doing that, you now have a horizontal and vertical polarized signal going between your two endpoints. And if there is interference, the odds of it interfering enough to create bit error that maybe collapses your link can be minimized. Think of it like common mode rejection on an audio cable, right? You have a balanced wire or you have unbalanced. So think of the dual polarization sort of like a balanced wire connection. I'm being very vague, not very, very broad strokes on this, but just sort of to give you an idea of why you spend the extra dollars to create this link. Now, this technology has been around a long time because it's used by a lot of folks in the petroleum industry. That's how they connect all those oil rigs out to sea back to the mainland through this technology. Usually licensed 5.8 gig or 3.2 gig or whatever the other bands are, depending where you're in the world. But in any case, it's the technology, the frequencies are still the same thing. It's just if you license it, you have something to argue over if somebody interferes with you. That's basically what it gives you. If you're unlicensed, you're at the mercy of whatever you design. And that's what I've been working with, and a lot of folks, a lot of radio stations are starting to realize that this technology does make sense and forego putting in the traditional, say, terrestrial T1 connection or terrestrial point-to-point equalized lines. You know, those things are still around, they're still available, and using the IP. Now, what's the benefit? The upside to this is not only do you put your audio across it with your codecs, but you can also extend your LAN if you choose, or you can create your own VLAN, and now you have a VLAN STL link that gets to your transmitter site, so you can do many things. In today's technologies, you can have all kinds of failover, because in the IP world, you can buy boxes, routers, or routers, depending where you are in the world, that will fail-safe or fail over to another IP circuit. So if you're really ambitious, you can do two radio links and set yourself up with routers that will fail back and forth. So there's a lot of stuff you can do, and it's actually relatively inexpensive when you do the total cost of ownership over a period of, say, 5 years, 3 years, depending on how you used to do the phone line. You know, T1s these days, you can still spend close to $600 a month for a T1. It's only 1.544 megabits in each direction. $600 a month, do the math, make a one-time purchase. Now you own the link, and the cost of increasing or decreasing the data rate, there is none. It's your pipeline. You built it out. So just, you know, that's what I've been working a lot on lately. And then I'm working with some folks in the video world with the same principles. And we're doing some wireless stuff with cellular, which has been a real treat. So if you want to do anything with cellular technology, be very careful. You're at the mercy of monopolies. And anyone who tells you you're not is an idiot. The technology, LTE, does work. The problem is the phone companies don't put it to its best use, and broadcasters do get the short end of the stick.
Speaking of now of the whole subject of IP radios, and I'm about to implement some IP radios for my first hands-on time, other than in the lab at Telos and Axia, down in Mississippi. Very low population density. I'm not anticipating RF issues, interference issues. Talk about the difference of licensed IP radios and unlicensed IP radios. Where do you have to go to a licensed plan and really plan it out well?
Well, the licensed plan is basically like you have your STLs on the 950 megahertz band. You have licensed frequencies in order to coordinate between the users. If you're in a metropolis or metropolitan area like, say, New York City, Chicago, Boston, you do a spectrum check. If 5.8 gig is busy, very much might be, then you may want to go with licensed. And then you apply for license and you protect yourself in that way. Hopefully, the coordination between those frequencies is done properly and you're okay to go. Unlicensed is just like your Wi-Fi at home. It's like your Wi-Fi router you buy at home. It's
here's a question. I tend to not live in areas that are as population dense as you do. So here in Nashville, and I live in a suburb of Nashville, so you know, there's not much Wi-Fi either at 2.4 or 5.8 gig going on around here. And we all know that of this technique called spread spectrum. You know, within a channel area, spread spectrum, and that allows more than one user to use a given piece of bandwidth at a time, and generally, up to a point, they don't interfere with each other. So I can have a Wi-Fi hotspot in my house on the same frequency as one next door, you know, 100 feet away, and it's generally quite usable. You don't notice a problem. Do you have a rule of thumb, or what do you think about when do you need to think about, you know what, let's move your Wi-Fi hotspot to a different frequency because I can see that that's clear. Sometimes I stay in a hotel in Cleveland, Ohio when I'm visiting Telos, and out the backside of this hotel, there's a big apartment building. Well, you turn on your computer and you search for a Wi-Fi hotspot, and there's 73 of them because there's this huge apartment complex right next door. So, you know, what's usable in a situation where there are all these users on the air? And, of course, I realize we're talking about broadcast here, so I assume that you don't want to get your email 90% of the time. You want your audio to be there 99.999% of the time. How do you make that value judgment about a frequency and if it's overused and in the light of spread spectrum and perhaps polarization possibilities, optimizations?
Right. Well, first of all, let's visit this. Wi-Fi, okay, we'll just use the phrase Wi-Fi, has in it, inherently in the design for the IEEE spec A2, was it 802.11a and C and B and D and A, has in it, by design, the ability to look at channels and move around and decide what will happen. And it's sort of like a first come, first serve. I forget there's a name for it, and I can't find it right now. There's an actual term for that technology that's part of the frequency hopping. So if you're in a hotel and you're on a 2.4 gig Wi-Fi system, the odds are you won't be able to get away from the interference if everybody's operating without any managed Wi-Fi. Okay, so there's the two things you have to watch out for. The managed Wi-Fi will get you connected and then follow you throughout the Wi-Fi bubble, I'll call it that. Then you have Wi-Fi that's just thrown up. People put up a hotspot or an access point on the floor, and off it goes. And then they hope for the best. No way to guarantee you're not going to get interference. That's just the way it goes. If you're lucky, 5.8 Wi-Fi has more channels, less overlap on different frequencies. So the chance of you losing bandwidth enough to fail to not get mail and other things is minimal. But that'll eventually, you know, grow out and people start having problems. Those are the two things to watch out for. So traveling Wi-Fi or even in your home. Like I have in my home two routers, and one of them is Wi-Fi 5.8, one's 2.4. And I can't tell you how many times the 2.4 one just collapses. I'm sitting there with my laptop, and it's just like, yeah, I'm not connecting. I got some kind of bandwidth. I can't make out what it is because it's just all noise.
But so, you're in a high-density area.
Oh, yes. Right. And I can look at, you know, Wi-Fi, get one of those little net stumblers, or there's many products out that you can look at the Wi-Fi spectrum. And, yeah, I can see, you know, right now if I turn it on, I can look at it, probably see 25 hotspots. Thank goodness they're all secure, so it's people aren't being stupid about, you know, giving away their bandwidth.
Didn't used to be that
they're
way.
They're there. Yeah. Yes, you can enjoy internet from your neighbors without them knowing it. So when it comes to radio stations or TV facilities and you're going to do linking, you know, studio transmitter, studio to studio, depending on where you are, the 5.8, you know, will work just fine. And if you do dual polarization, and there's certain products that are out there that do spectrum or OFDM stuff, their boxes are designed, and you can turn it on or off, to jump between frequencies to minimize interference. They actually have algorithms in them to sort of minimize
it. So, I should point out that kind of frequency hopping you're talking about right now, where it listens to see what's out there, says, oh, well, this channel's really tied up. Let me go, this is pretty empty. I'll go over here automatically. That is different than spread spectrum, where you're hopping within a given channel range. You know,
spectrum has... Wi-Fi does spread spectrum too, and it's all predetermined time slots, the whole bit.
Spread
spectrum is just a broad term these days. You know, years ago it was just basically one thing. Now it's become a huge, you know, algorithm based design. That's why you'll see a lot of these 5.8 radio links tout low interference or your ability to do this and do that, because now they've got algorithms they've written into that spread spectrum the time slot generator, and says, okay, let's go do this. We're going to monitor this to see what energy bits we have, and we'll move back and forth. It's pretty cool. I mean, when you start getting into it, it's like, whoa. And depending on your link, and the trick is, what people forget, if you have a link in the IP world, IP radio, your link is 1 mile in distance from point A to point B. Depending on how you design that radio and what bandwidth and modulation you choose will dictate the bandwidth you get. It's not assumed you'll get 100 megabits if your radio is designed for 100 megabits. You've got to be careful with that. The same is true if you go with that same radio setup and go 6 miles out. You're not going to get 100 megabits unless you design it accordingly, which means you have to have enough link budget, RF signal, to get between the points. So these are the things you have to look at, and it gets more detailed. So, you know, like I just recently did a 4 mile link between a studio and transmitter, and thank goodness it's literally flat land between the two locations. So there's no Fresnel zone issues to worry about, everything else.
If Andrew could... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't interrupt.
I was going to say, but that 4 miles, I had to determine which form of modulation would work to get me the 100 megabits I needed, because I was pushing it at the edge, because I was only using a 2-foot flat panel in the studio side, because they were not allowed to put a 2-foot dish on the
parapet. Oh, really?
Right.
So
because
you had sighting issues there, sight issues.
Well, sight issues in the sense of aesthetics, not the window was clean. There was no Mylar, no lead-based, not lead-based these days, it's something else they call it. They put the film in for the heat sense, for the building heat. And what we did was at the transmitter side, since we had no issue with aesthetics, we put a 4-foot dish out there. Now, you know, some people say, oh, that'll work, that makes up the difference. Yes and no. It does give you a little more to work with, but remember, the 4-foot dish is going to benefit more. That receiver, transceiver, is going to be much better than the one at the studio that's got the 2-foot flat panel. But it helps you to design what you can work with, and that's what's nice about IP. You dictate the guard bands or the parameters by which you'll operate under. Whereas in the past, if you had a T1, you are basically at the mercy of the phone company doing the proper clocking and everything else involved. And you would hope
that's
you're...
the good point, something else I would point out is if you have a T1, you have 1.5 whatever it is megabits per second, and that's what you have. You may have other faster services available, IP services from various carriers now, but if you can do your own IP radio and you can get a clear path, even if you have to do a hop point somewhere, if it's your equipment, and especially if it's licensed, but even to some degree if it's not licensed, you may have the opportunity to have a much bigger pipe between where you are and where you want to be. So, in fact, this is what I'm doing in Mississippi. We have a transmitter site that doesn't really have a possibility to get any IP services out there. But we have a nice clear shot. We're doing a 950 megahertz analog shot now from a 40 feet up at the studio and about 100 feet up at the transmitter site. But we're going to do that again for an IP hop, just with little Ubiquiti dishes. If I get a chance to run over here and get one, I will and show it. And we'll get some IP connectivity out there, which – now we have a world of IP things to connect to, like our Nautel transmitter and the AUI display. We'll be able to look at that. So I'm delighted about that possibility. Hey, we were talking about here's a hack. I guess we got to get back into hacks. So here is Wi-Fi Analyzer, popular little application for Android, and I guess they have it for iPhone as well. And I'm looking at on Channel 6, and a lot of things come on Channel 6, right, on the 2.4 gig spectrum, is my hotspot called, I call it Ghost of Otis. There's a long story there. So that's my hotspot. And there's not much else. And if I go upstairs, I'm in the basement here in the lab, but if I go upstairs, we'll see several different hotspots on there from neighbors. But down here, it doesn't matter. And turns out they're not using Channel 6, so that's good. What about we talked about briefly about license versus unlicensed. If you go licensed, you've got opportunities for other bands to go in. You wouldn't license yourself in the 2.4 gig band, I take it.
No, in the United States, it's 3.6 gig.
Ah, okay. And aren't there some other ones? Aren't there some real high ones, 11 or 17
gig?
Well,
there's the 11 gig and 23 gig that you can also do. Again, as I pointed out earlier, that's where the you get what you pay for. So if you want to go up there, you can, and you can do a lot with it. But then also remember the penalties at 11 gig and 23 gig, your path, your link budget, rain fade, and many other things fall into play. So if you can do 3.6 and manage it properly, then you're like sort of in the middle of where you want to be.
But that's a good point. You can do that. And that rule of thumb is that the higher the frequency, the less of an aberration in the path that it takes to decrease the signal. A swarm of birds in front of somewhere in the path at 23 gig can certainly hurt things. And of course, the more common thing is rain fade. You get a lot of rain in that path, and it's going to wipe out a 23 gig path. It's going to hurt an 11 gig path. It won't do so badly with a 3.6 gig path, and not as badly with a 2.4 gig path either.
Right. Yeah. And you have all these conditions, but the nice thing is there are formulas and mathematics involved that you can calculate and figure it out. And also, you can always have a failover to something hardwired. So you have a DSL site, DSL line or cable modem at your transmitter site. If you have that luxury, or maybe you do need to have one there for something else.
Well, here's a hack. This is what our previous guest we had on the show, Dave Anderson, is doing at all of his transmitter sites. And he's got seven or including some translators. He's up to 10 or 11 transmitter sites now. And he tries to get wired internet, whether it's DSL or cable, to every transmitter site. Plus, he tries to get a second internet feed. And in some cases, that second internet feed is a cradle point travel router or point of sale router with a Verizon 4G LTE USB modem on it, or the dedicated kind of router that has that built in. And that's not as primary, but you know what? It works well enough, often enough, to where it's a good backup. There's also a few cases where he can't get a second form of internet to a transmitter site because usually they're out in the boonies, or oftentimes they are. So he'll find the nearest place that does have internet that he can get access to. Maybe it's a fellow engineer or a ham radio operator or a business that's friendly to the radio station. So they'll make an arrangement with that business. Hey, let us put up a little 20-foot tower out back. We're going to pay for your internet, but we're going to take some of it. and we're going to put a Ubiquiti or some other brand of dish up, and you know, IP radio, and shoot it out to our transmitter site, which at that point may only be 3 or 4 miles away or 8 miles away. It's not a, you know, a 40 or 100 mile shot from all the way from the studio. So you get it as far as you can go, and then you hop it where it needs to go. If those public if those, you know, common carriers or cable companies can't get it out there to you, and I think that's a great hack to get internet two sources of it if you're using it for STL to your transmitter site by whatever means that it may take.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done that. CradlePoint's a great product to use. There's a couple of them out there, and I've done the exact same thing. Yeah, that's one of the other things. That's what's nice about it. See, as I said earlier, you can control and design how you want to do things. It's your design, your control.
So we've been talking about pretty sophisticated modern day hacks right now, but I want to roll back to a couple of old school hacks. Okay.
Sure, I got one.
So maybe you've got an audio console that has no way to do a mix minus on it. Maybe you've got an old fashioned console where you've got a fader or a knob, maybe it's a rotary knob fader, and you've got a switch above it for program or audition, but not both. You can put that audio in the program bus or in the audition bus, but you can't put it in both buses. And there's no third bus, a utility bus or a telephone bus. Of course, modern consoles, even consoles that are 20 years old, oftentimes program and utility could be selected at the same time. And so you could send audio from a given fader to program and to utility or audition, if you will. Some consoles had a built-in phone bus, if you will, and even the type of module that it was decided whether or not it was going to be part of that. But let's say you've got an older console, no possibility to come up with a mixed minus. And by the way, remember, why do you want a mixed minus? Well, if you're carrying on conversations with people who are remote, you usually can't send them themselves. So the purpose of mixed minus, you don't want if there's somebody on the other end of a phone connection or an audio codec, an IP codec or whatever it may be, an ISDN connection, you can't send them themselves. You need to send them everything on the console except themselves, and that's mix minus. So the fader that's bringing in your guest, your remote person, you want that fader to certainly go to program on the console like everything else is, but you don't want that fader to feed into the same bus that's back feeding to this remote person. So how do you do that if you have a console that can't do any mix minus? Well, what some people think about, does the caller at the other end, does the other person at the other end, do they have to hear absolutely everything, or could they get by with just hearing the main mic or a mix of all the studio mics? So at some stations, you might go take a field mixer like a Shure mixer or maybe something from Rain, and you'll put your mics into that, or you'll split your mics. Maybe the mics come in, you know, several faders on the console. You can split those mic feeds either with the split transformers, a whirlwind device, or you could possibly even just do a hard split of the mic and feed it to two places, feed it to the console and feed it to this mixer. And then you bring up all the mics in this mixer, and the output of that mixer is all the mics. You could even bring in, you know, other things if you had to, but you certainly don't bring in the thing that you want to send the mix minus to. So you don't bring your hybrid or your codec into that. So usually it's just the mics. And you take the output of this mixer and you feed that to the caller or the codec send. And here you have a hack. You've just made a mix minus or kind of a mix minus. You're sending the audio to the caller that they need to hear without having to have a mix minus on the console. I'll bet you've done that before, Chris.
Oh yeah, back in the early days, yes. And some of the consoles I had, we actually used the Audition, or sometimes I used to call it a P2 bus, and that would be my mix minus. I would just tell the jocks all these buttons stay in except that one labeled telephone. And sometimes I'd have to just remove that switch because, you know, some disc jockeys just like to play with things. And
Now here's a modern take on that hack though. You just mentioned that this key thing. If you set up the Audition bus on a console as one mix minus, but you need another mix minus. Maybe you've got two hybrids, or maybe you've got a hybrid and you've got a codec, and you need to create a mix minus for each of these things. You got an audition bus. You can use that. Maybe you've got a utility bus. Some consoles had that. Maybe you've got a telephone bus. Some consoles had that. Maybe you've got a non-broadcast console, but you've got a, you know, a Behringer or a Mackie type of mixer, and you've got some auxiliary buses. Well, you can use those. But the point here is that you, the engineer, set this up. Okay, I want to assign this fader and this fader and this fader and this fader into this bus. But if you know, a disc jockey, an operator goes and touches a button, either removes it from a bus where it should be or adds it to a bus where it shouldn't be, then you're screwed up. And then, you know, your mix minus is no longer proper. Well, in modern day electronic consoles, like from Axia or I don't know, but I'm sure from Wheatstone or SAS or other companies, these bus assignments can be stored. And then if an operator messes it up, you can, you know, recall a profile and bam, you're good to go again. You're back to the proper setup. And this is a real benefit for stations who have operators that don't really know what a mix minus is. They just know that it needs to work. Chris, what's been your experience in this modern solution?
Oh, it works great. We had the Axia consoles in one place I was at, and we built several profiles for people so that when they did that exact thing, when they played around and made a mistake, they just knew to hit this one button to reset the console. We did the same thing with the Vistamax console system we installed in another facility. Also had profiles for that. Yeah, that's, you know, nowadays is, you know, it's a no-brainer. You can, you know, like I always say, most jocks or studio operators, on-air presenters, I don't expect them to know the details about mix minus or any of the other things we all take for granted. But I do try to offer them tools to find their way back home when they get lost. So it's sort of like a Hansel and Gretel, you know, modern-day breadcrumbs.
And again, I can't speak for other manufacturers. I don't know about their stuff, but you know, a console like an Axie console, every fader can create its own mix minus. You don't actually have to use up a bus to do that. It's got the, because it's all software, it's all DSP. The designer of the console has the opportunity to do that. Say, well, every time that, you know, this fader is in use, it's turned on, we're going to create a mix of all the other faders minus this fader and make that available as an output. And that works great, especially when you have an audio over IP type of system. So, okay, so that was one hack. There's another hack I've got to mention before I have to get out of here. So, Chris, you're familiar with the good old transmitter, the Harris FM, maybe it's an FM5H, maybe an FM10H.
Oh, yeah. I had one of those.
The H series, yeah. Kind of battleship green.
FM25K.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now the ones I'm thinking of are the ones that had the blower floor mounted in the bottom, right? In the bottom of the cabinet. And then the tube cavity started about, mid-chest level. Yeah. And there had to be a tube, to get the air from the blower output, which is pointed up from the bottom of the cavity, or the bottom of the cabinet, you had to have a big tube to carry that air to the bottom of the tube cavity, where it would go in and hit the bottom of the of the base of the tube, then flow past the first deck, and then go past all the tube fins, and then go out the top, a lot hotter than it started, right?
Yes, exactly.
So this tube, at least on the Harris FM H series, was a custom-made canvas tube, right?
The early days, yes, they were. They were
3.5 feet long, maybe almost 4 feet long, 3.5 feet long,
that
certainly.
Material that would deteriorate.
About that big around, and made of, I think it was white canvas or an off-white canvas?
It was off-white, yeah.
Really heavy-duty stuff, and then the clamps, as I recall, the output of the blower was a square output, and the input to the bottom of the cavity, wasn't it square as well? And there was some kind of a squares clamp, or was it really round?
On some models, it was round. I think the early versions may have been square, and then they found out that in the field it was becoming difficult to, you know, to maintain.
I'll tell you what the square ones did. You know, this is the same reason, by the way, or a similar reason why airplane windows are not rectangular. They're rounded on the corners because you don't want to present a place where there's extra pressure against the aluminum skin of the fuselage, because they were having tears and breaks on early pressurized airplanes. So same thing here. If you have this square output from the blower and you put a round canvas tube on it, and then you clamp the canvas tube with a square clamp, what you end up having is at the corners, you have points where the canvas is sitting there, you know, kind of tugging and pulling and tugging and pulling and vibrating all the time with the air going past it. And it's putting a little pressure on this point at each of the four corners. So eventually the canvas gets old, it wears out here, and it starts to tear, you know, along the line there. And before you know it, you have your canvas tube is broken. You've got no more good solid connection for air between the blower and the bottom of the tube cavity. So if you're out at a transmitter site in the middle of a bean field in Mississippi and your canvas tube is torn up and your transmitter won't run because you're not getting air to the tube cavity, what do you do? Well, one possibility is you take your pants off and you take your scissors or a knife and you cut a pant leg off. And you clamp the pant leg. now you've got a denim tube, right? A pant leg. And you clamp it to the bottom and you clamp it to the top, hoping that you didn't have the straight leg ones, you know, or that are too small at one end. Or maybe it's a boot cut, but whatever they are, bell bottoms, those will work.
The boot cut would be nice and firm and, you know, nice, snug.
But if it's too snug, it may not fit. It's got to be big enough to fit, and you can't cut a dart in it to make it bigger because that'll, you know, make it weak there and it won't hold the air. Anyway, clamp it. So I actually never had to do this myself, but I came across it. Would I have thought of this? Would I have thought to take my pants off and cut a leg off and make a replacement air tube for the transmitter? I don't know. Would you have thought of that?
Probably at some point I would have if I was desperate enough. But I will tell you that I did have to use and I didn't use pants legs because in this case we had the blower motor itself failed. So it didn't matter what we stuck between the blower motor and the tube cavity. But I had to use the room air conditioner, and I fabricate a mount out of, I think I did plastic, packing plastic materials or cardboard cuts. And I put it over the louvers on a window air conditioning vents and built a block and then a small little circle. And then that on that would be, those flexible plastic wired accordion vent hoses you use for your dryer at home.
Yeah.
Well, we had a couple of those for something. I'm not sure why we had them, but we did. And I said, okay, we took that and then stretched out and put it to the back of the transmitter, removed the blower motor, pop this bellows in its place, and began to use the cold air from there to run it in. So I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. And then I started realizing, I said, wait a minute, if I remember my fluid dynamics and temperature differentials required for cooling a tube, iMac class 101, we are going to run into a problem in about an hour. And why? Because back in the day, it was very popular to vent the hot air into the room because you wanted to keep a closed system in your transmitter building. So you minimize bringing in the dirt and dust by having the building a negative pressure in the building. So negative pressure brings dirt in, positive pressure pushes it out. However, that's based on a certain dynamic, heat load versus cooling. So now I've got an air conditioner that was not meant to cool a tube that's running at about, it was 3 kilowatts. I think the temperature of the stack typically on a normal day was around 110 degrees. Yeah, so, you know, the air conditioner wasn't meant to do that. So we then had to take the same bellows material and vent out the tube heat out of the room. So we created sort of like an air conditioning world. It's what you call a circulation through plenum. The supply comes into the room and the plenum draws it out. You create a high and low pressure environment. It didn't happen in minutes. It took us a while to figure this out. I had to do a lot of reading in books that the internet didn't exist at the time. And it made it work. And we were able to get by for about 4 days before the new blower motor arrived. And the guys at the transmitter company, it was a Rockwell Collins transmitter. Now, at the time, it was Continental Electronics managing all that stuff. And the guys at Continental were like, wow. We would have thought by the second day the tube would have melted. But I guess you got just the right differential between the in and out. It was enough to maintain it. So it worked. Wow. So that's a hack, and I'll never forget that one. That was a classic. I was just like, and the guy, and this is me, and by the way, I just started work at this radio station out of college. I was there for 6 months, and I was the young guy, always coming up with these wacky things. I did some stuff with audio matrixing. I did some stuff in the studios. The engineer I was working with, the guy was 65 years old, and he's looking at me like, you young kids think you could do anything. I'm like, no, I'm just having fun. I said, you know, tell me what I should do better because I'm learning under your tutelage. And then he went on vacation, the blower motor dies. I had to come up with something crazy. He shows up at the transmitter site the next week, read the email, or the mail that we had. Yeah, we had email at the time, just barely. And He was like, okay, I read this and I had to come see it for myself. And he went out to the transmitter site on the Sunday, went into the room and saw this wacky contraption and goes, wow, never thought that would work, but that was pretty good. So, you know, it's just one of those things. There's many hacks I've done stuff like that in the past. It's kind of wacky.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to talk about our sponsor for just a minute. And we're going to come back with some more engineering hacks. We've got had a couple of good ideas for here from Bob Holowenko in the chat room. If you want to join us in the chat room, do so. Go to gfqlive.tv. Maybe you're already there watching live. And jump in the chat room and talk about your favorite engineering hack or something that you think could be done or that you have done to get around a problem. You know, by the way, I'm sure there's been a few Western Electric 111C repeat coils that have been used as hacks to solve a problem.
Oh, yeah.
Consider that. Our show is brought to you by the way, you are watching This Week in Radio Tech, episode number 202. It's Kirk and Chris show today. Andrew Zarian is going to be joining us in a few minutes because I've got to jet out of here. I'm on a trip out of town, and I can't change the time, so I got to go. And Andrew Zarian and Chris Tobin will continue on with a few hacks. Andrew has, you know, he's figured out a few hacks of himself in the studio environment, so I wish I could hear the end of the show. I'll try to listen in the car. Ooh, that might be dangerous. Our show is brought to you by the folks at the Telos Alliance. And I want to tell you about something that's kind of cool. You know, usually you wouldn't just advertise a website, but I want to have you go to the new Telos Alliance website. It is gorgeous, and better than gorgeous, we're just filling it with lots of information. So if you go there at telosalliance.com, you'll see some big pictures at the top with a few of our favorite users. Tom Nelson, for example, at Minnesota Public Radio, one of the first people to put in a huge AOIP system. Dave Anderson of the Joy FM, he's been a guest on our show, using audio over IP, audio over the public internet to feed his transmitter sites. Andrew Jeffries with Clear Channel Media in Los Angeles, big fan of the Omnia 11 audio processor. Okay, but more than advertising, if you scroll down a bit over to the Tech Talk area and click on Read More, it's going to take you to the opening page of our blog. And this is our tech blog. So we give you a lot of great ideas. More are being added every week. Here's at the top of the blog here is an article posted by Clark Novak. It's about setting up Axia GPIO connections for AC and DC. It's an interview or some ideas from Laura Gutknecht, the technical director at WUSM at the University of Wisconsin. She needed to get some GPIO connections going and figured out some good things there. There's also how to direct dial your ZIP1 IP audio codec, how to get GPIO to run your on-air lights in an Axia system. There's an article and an accompanying video by me about doing easy smartphone remotes with a Telos ZIP1 and the Lucy Live software. Questions answered, too, like what's the maximum cable length between Axia components and an Ethernet switch? So lots and lots of articles here and many, many more as well if you click on some stuff at the bottom. I also want you to take notice, though, of this the sign-up sheet on the left. Subscribe to Direct Current. Now, Direct Current is the new name for our newsletter. We used to call it e-news, and it was about once a month. Now we're sending out Direct Current about once a week. And I don't feel like you're gonna feel like you're getting spammed, because Direct Current is not a bunch of advertising about Telos products. It's links to this kind of blog articles and what other people are doing to solve problems in their studios and at their transmitter sites. So if you'll check that out and subscribe to the Direct Current, easy to do. Just fill out your name and email address and what company you're with, what country that you're in, and bam, we'll get Direct Current off there. Phone number's optional. You don't have to fill it out if you don't want to. Also, lots of links for more of these articles that are in this technical blog. Lots to see and lots to learn here at this Tech Talk blog. Oh, wow. Got a tip to share? Let us know. And if we use your tip, we'll send you a license for Omnia AXE streaming audio, valued at $395. So there's even some financial incentive to share your story with the Telos Alliance and maybe a hack that you're doing or some way that you're putting our gear or our software to use. All right, check it out. It's at telosalliance.com. Appreciate them for sponsoring the show. All right. Oh, and all of our manuals are always available online. You don't have to sign up. They're just there. You don't have to sign your life away and tell us anything like that. Just download. All right. We are talking about engineering hacks on this episode of This Week in Radio Tech. It's worthwhile to point out that there's a guy who actually puts engineering hacks together every month. Is it once a month or twice a month? At least every month in Radio World magazine. And that's John Bissett. John now actually works for Telos full time. But he's still doing, as far as I know, I've seen him. He's still doing his workbench article. And there's a lot of cool hacks, tips, and tricks, and ideas. I was just looking through one, getting myself reminded about the DOS command ARP space minus A. And this will show you all the other devices that I have IP addresses that are on the same switch. Now, it may not show you stuff that are being separated through a managed switch. But at least on a hub environment, you can see other things that are using this. That's a real quick, kind of a quick IP scan is the ARP command. There's an article that John has about how to turn old iPhones, if you have an old iPhone, you might, how to turn old iPhones into security cameras. Well, that's kind of an interesting hack. Actually, I've done that with an iPad. If you need an emergency replacement for a porcelain insulator standoff, well, your hardware store may have some PVC supplies that will help you with that. John wrote an article about doing exactly that. There's an article about how to build a low power dummy load that, you know, keeps the impedance right. Maybe the equivalent of the old cantenna that Heathkit used to have. Putting a scrap satellite dish to good use. So I just did a Google search for John Bissett, B-I-S-S-E-T. No, not two T's, just one T. John Bissett, and I searched for John Bissett and workbench, and found a link to it. Just a whole bunch of John's workbench articles. Great hacks. All right, Chris, what else have you got for us? You got any more hacks we can talk about? Idea starters?
Yes, actually, this is old. I'll go back to the old school stuff again. But actually, you can do it today because it's probably out there. If you recall, there was a transition time period between the old dedicated copper loops, okay, dedicated lines between studio transmitter, studio to studio that you get from the phone company, 15KC loops, okay, kilohertz loops. And then they migrated to something called digital technology, which allowed them to take the same wideband uncompressed audio you normally put into a phone line, but digitize it and put it across a pair, you know, a single pair of wires to the central office, and then pass it on to the other end, to the studio or transmitted link, wherever you're going. And those products were called, they were made by a company called XEL, and they used to call them program channel system units. Now, I had come across these units. We used them in many places over the years, and I wound up collecting some of them because the phone company would leave them behind when we abandoned sites. One day, I got a hold of the paperwork for it. And if you can see this, I don't know if it comes out okay. Probably won't. But anyway.
Yeah, starting to.
Yeah, I got to get the right angle. In any case, I started reading the little spec sheet that came with it and realized these units can be set up in a master-slave arrangement over a pair of wires. So I said, wow, I'm doing some remotes in a stadium. Oh, I'm sorry, in a music arena, and I need to get some audio from backstage out to our front of house console, and the place says we can use their in-house wiring, and we tried to use it, and the buzzes and noise and clicks were like, oh boy. So I had a pair of these units, and I give it a try. Took out a Belden roller cable, spun out the 8451 from the back of stage out to the front where we were through the cable tray, put the slave unit at the stage side, put the master at my end, and guess what I got? 15 kilohertz uncompressed stereo back to me. So I can take, and I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. Fast forward a few years, and Pulsecom comes out with the APTX version of the same thing, which means you can do compressed audio over longer distances because it was designed that way because it uses 2B1Q modulation. And I did the same thing for a news event. We were doing a press conference, couldn't get the audio where we needed to because of the location, roll out some cable, pop these guys on. We had it. So it was like, it's a hack, but it's something you may not come across often, but I bet you good percentage of people in the audience have these units sitting on the wall in a phone closet doing nothing and go, wow, if you have a pair of them, you can actually make little umbilicals, you know. Granted, today you could buy other things that do the same thing in IP, but it was just something we did, and I carried them in a little road case and kept them for remotes, and it came in very handy on many occasions.
I love it. Hey, Chris, I'm going to give you one. I mean, you may have your own. I got to leave right now, but I want you to wrap the show up in the next, you know, 5-10 minutes or so. But I want to give you this notion. Remember the days when we used those 111C repeat coils, and you know, to use an unloaded dry telephone pair,
yep,
from the studio to the transmitter, right? And then, mm-hmm, we came up with doing this in stereo. So we had 111C repeat coil for the left and for the right. At the other end, we may have had an equalizer, probably did, but you could also run it through a transformer first. The point is, these 111C repeat coils had just the most perfect center tap on them, and on both the input side and the output side. Now, with the stereo pair of these, so you got four wires from here to there, terminated each end, each pair terminated by a transformer that had a center tap on it. Add another pair of transformers. So now you got a total of six transformers. What was the hack that you could do to get some free audio from here to there?
Oh, that's interesting. I'm trying to remember that. I used to do DC between the coils to do
relay. Oh, DC? Control. Well, yeah, from the center task. But you could.
I did that for a couple of things.
Granted, you might hear some crosstalk way down, 60, 70, 80 dB down. But you could take the center tap of the left transformer, take the center tap of the right transformer. Now, this is on the phone company side. Okay.
Right. Gotcha.
Take the center taps there. Bring those taps, one from the left channel, one from the right channel, bring those taps to a third transformer. Then on the other side of that transformer, apply your audio. At the transmitter side, do the same thing. Center tap of the telco side, go to another transformer. You're sending audio in the common mode on the left channel, right, and the common mode on the right channel. And as long as there's nothing stupid in the way between the two sites, this would work fine. You could get a free audio channel. And you can send the audio in either direction with this thing, right? So
yes.
I used it to bring we had a Marty receiver at the transmitter site because it was up high on a hill, and great reception from there. So we had a Marty receiver in the transmitter shack, antenna way up on the tower. We had this Marty audio, but how do you get it back to the studio? Well, you could inject it in the subcarrier of the FM, and some people did that, but there was a real audio quality limitation there. 6 kilohertz or something like that. So we built up this phantom audio circuit from the existing left and right center taps and got audio back to the studio. Now, we did have a little tiny bit of crosstalk. If it was remote, if we were using the Marty for a remote on the AM station, you could hear a little bit of crosstalk on the FM. But if you're using it for a remote on the FM, you never noticed it because it was, you know, almost in phase and it just worked fine.
That's great. I worked at a station. We did have that kind of a setup. I totally
there
forgot about that. That was a long time, but we did it the same thing. It was for the Marty. It was for the RPA receiver.
Yeah,
and I remember there was a note on the receiver. Do not. It was this trick. I think that's what they were getting. How we got by the crosstalks to some degree. I do remember between the phone company points, it's 150 ohms, and the customer side 600. And there was a note on the receiver that said when the phone line is connected, do not exceed what was it? Minus 10 dBm or something on the output of the box, on the receiver. And I was like, what the heck is this about? And then at the other end, we had an amp, you know, a preamp that would bring it back up to get into the console. And now that you mentioned the crosstalk, that's probably what it was. I never even thought about it because, you know, at the time we were just doing things to make things happen. But that makes total sense. No, there was a lot of people. I used to do a DC between the coils to do relay controls for transmitter stuff.
Yeah, of course,
you know, the phone companies go and doing testing and they go, of course, with the buttons, and like, what the heck was that?
But you were using common mode of each side,
yes,
but you were making another pair from
right
the center. Yeah, yeah, by doing common mode.
Oh, yeah. A couple of times the phone company would call up and say, hey, we think we have a leaky cables situation. You've got DC on your pairs. We're going to have to take it offline to fix it.
No, it's okay.
And I have
it's
to
okay,
like
really
quickly
okay
call back. No, I think the problem's solved. There was a guy here the other day. I lifted the voltage off the line.
The problem's
and
solved.
And they call back. Hey, all right, it's gone. Okay, thanks. I'm like, oh, there goes that little freebie.
Hey, audience, hey, thanks for being with us. Stay with us. Chris Tobin and Andrew Zarian are gonna take you out of here. I got to run. You guys have a great week. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. And Chris, if you'd wrap it up at your convenience whenever you want to, I got to go. See you guys later.
All right, Kirk. Safe travels. All right, audience. We're going to go to the chat room and see what we have. I think somebody was asking about, let's see, we were talking earlier about antennas. Xandra, you going to come in on the voice-only side of this?
I'm here on the voice-only.
This is a voice-only operation. Okay.
But I do have a couple questions for you, Chris. Podcasting hacks, if you want to talk about that.
Sure, why not?
There's a lot of corners that a lot of podcasters need to cut due to, you know, financial reasons or at the last second something breaks. Something that I had to do once, I had a problem with my main mixer. It totally went bad. It was a Mackie mixer. It just died right before I was supposed to go on the air. So I had a smaller mixer. I hooked it up, but the problem was I didn't have enough outputs out of that mixer. I had a main out and I had a tape out, and that was it. Nothing else. So what I ended up doing was I took the main out and I got a distribution amp, a RCA distribution amp. Plugged it in there, and then I distributed the audio to all the devices that needed to hear the audio. Very, you know, not the best way to do it, but it worked.
Well, actually, no, that's a good way to do it, because the key with distributing audio is to keep the levels, the impedance or the levels between devices equal. So the distribution amp actually provides that buffer. If you just did a hard wire, like I've walked in a couple of places that called me up and said, I'm having issues with my levels on my devices. I don't know why. I walk in and they've taken their RCA output and just spliced more RCA connectors onto the one output and plugged it into all the devices. And it's like, well, there is a certain amount of electronics, mathematics that goes into this. And once you start doing that, it creates havoc. So using a distribution amp, though it may appear to be a hack, is actually the proper way. Now, using RCA jacks, which is unbalanced audio, is not a bad thing as long as you properly terminate and connect and do the right thing. And then you're off to races. And there's also a hack that people, there used to be in one of the trade magazines, I don't know if you can see this, and I've got to change my lighting here. But in any case, this allows you to, to take a balanced connection and make it unbalanced. So for a cheap little schematic like this, you can still use your unbalanced mixers with professional equipment if you happen to be receiving donations from, say, a radio station or somewhere. Just one of those things. So that's a hack you can do. That's really cool.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. Now that we have the Axia gear in the studio, I've kind of forgotten a lot of the crazy, weird ways we used to do things.
Oh, yeah.
And every now and then, like, I'll just be cleaning up the studio or something, and I'll be like, wow, I can't believe we did it that way. I don't even know how it worked, but it did.
Well, that's how you get to the places we're at today. Okay, GFQ starts out in the infancy of an idea. It migrates to or evolves to another idea. And as you go along that path, you do all these little hacks. And that's what gets you farther along. And then the day comes when you're able to graduate, if you will, to the higher level. And now you don't have to worry about hacking anymore. But you wouldn't have gotten to the higher level if you hadn't done the learning process. Because if you did, if somebody just walked up to you today, you know, say 5 years ago, here you go, guys. Here's a brand new IP distributed audio system for you to play with and go off. And you would have no idea what it would take to do it right. You'd do stuff and be like, this thing sucks. But because you went through that graduated evolution, you learn the principles, the foundation, and you say, hey, I can appreciate what I got now because of where I came from. And that's what podcasters need to remember. You know, those of us who are doing stuff in your home or home office, it's not a bad thing. Just learn from what you're doing. It's like Andrew pointed out. I had a distribution amp. I had the RCA. I only had this one way to do it. That's right. That's the proper way to do it. And you happen to stumble across the proper way. No one told you that, but you just assumed it was bad.
Sure. I mean, some of the other things, I mean, that we do wrong is, you know, we won't. Like, it's not necessarily a hack, but more like a tip. A lot of people are not doing tip ring sleeve. They're not using TRS cables. And, you know, a thing that plagues a lot of podcasters is an awful ground loop.
Well, that's because most folks today, unlike many, many years ago, which was a do-it-yourself environment, if those of you in the audience remember, there's Radio Shack where you could buy parts to build things, and there was Lafayette Radio Electronics and many other places. And you would build stuff. So you knew the difference between a tip ring sleeve, TRS cable, and a ring sleeve only, ring only cable like an RCA jack. And you understood what the differences and why you need to do stuff. Today, we're so accustomed to be able to buy something off the shelf, you plug it in, it works. And in the computer world, it just happens to work most of the time, so we don't even bother to learn the foundation. This goes back to what I was saying earlier with the evolutionary steps that GFQ took to learn what they have today. So you learn those basics, and then tip ring sleeve is easy to use. You'd be like, oh, now I understand why I'm not having any more problems. This is great.
But that RCA distribution amp, really went a long way for me for a while until I got my mixer back.
Yeah, but that's what they do. You know, that's what you use them for. Trust me, I've built many a facility where we had 15, 20 distribution amps in a rack, and we were distributing audio to a plant with 27 studios, 56 channels of satellite uplinking audio, and that's the way you did it. But every one of them, when you put a tone in at, say, 0 dB on the meter, it came out 0 dB everywhere else in the plant, because that's what you needed to have. If we had done it just the old-fashioned way, which some people used to do, which was just split the wires, you know, at some point we would probably had some places where it just didn't work right. So, you know, that's how it goes. It's not a bad thing.
Let's see. You've been in the studio, and we've discussed this a bunch of times. I mean, most of the time when we grab a drink, we're talking, you know, shop, and we're talking about ways to kind of get things to work properly. In the podcasting world, I think, you know, cutting corners is very common, and I kind of encourage it. You know, learn how to do it on the cheap, and learn how to do it properly, like with soundproofing, for example. None of us are broadcasting in great, you know, soundproofed studios or rooms. A lot of times you hear a lot of room noise. Something that I did, I got these curtains from, I think it was Target, and they're supposed to be sound dampening curtains. And they're nothing special, nothing that you pick up in a music store. They're just regular curtains, and it says sound dampening on them. They're a thicker material, and I'll tell you, Chris, it really changed the sound of the studio.
It will. Well, yeah, there's two things to remember. Soundproofing and sound treatment are two different terms and two different applications of the technology. So here's how it goes. What you did was sound treatment. So the room itself needed treatment because the four walls, or three, depending on the size, whatever the room is, needed to be treated because they're reflective. And a way to simply test the room's liveliness, which now, remember, in audio, we're so accustomed to hearing things in the stereo mode, two ears, or what they call binaural. So our brains automatically adjust for things. So we walk into a room that's very loud and echoey, we'll call it that. Your brain automatically knows how to compensate for those echoes and sort of subdues them or suppresses them enough so that you can hear what's important. Microphones, radio equipment, podcasting encoders do not do that. They will take whatever they hear and pass it on. So in the case of GFQ's studio, which was very lively, if you walk into a room, snap your fingers just above your head, and if you hear it reflecting back and forth, bouncing back, and listen to how long it takes to bounce back, that's the degree of the liveliness of the room. So the sound dampening or sound treatment is used to reduce those echoes. So by you using the curtains, the fabric that you got, hanging it up on the walls, and depending on where you place it in relation to the microphone, helps reduce the reflections. Now, you don't want zero reflections. Zero reflections makes a dead room and becomes very uneasy to talk in. Your body needs, your ears need to have a little bit of noise in order to understand balance. And trust me, if you ever walked into a studio that was totally soundproofed and isolated from the building itself to create a completely isolated environment, you walk in and you suddenly stop and you sort of lose your balance. Your body is like, whoa, what happened? So just these are just the background. I'm not expecting people to understand the full physics involved, but that's the difference between sound treatment and soundproofing. So I'm in a room that is not soundproofed, but I've treated two of the three walls so that the amount of echo that I have is minimal. If I stay close to the microphone where I'm at, which is a typical distance, you know, the old finger, index finger, thumb and pinky, it should be reasonable, acceptable to use. If I step back like this, you should start to hear a little bit of the room because I have a ceiling above me. A wall to the side that's not treated. So that's what you're going to hear. And that's how you learn to balance what you have. And sound treatment's the easiest way to go. I mean, most rooms, four walls, remember, think of it as light. Sound bounces. You speak into a microphone. The sound goes into the microphone, goes past the microphone to whatever object's beyond you. So if that object is reflective, like an LCD screen of a computer, the odds are you're going to get something reflected back. Now, when it reflects back, it doesn't only come back to you straight. It may come back to you at an angle to the tabletop. So now the tabletop becomes a reflector. So now you've got two reflections. And then if those reflections come back in the wrong way, guess what? It sounds phasey. And you know, like you don't know why it doesn't sound right. That's what they call comb filtering. So the trick is sound treat the walls. Try and use a sound treatment on the tabletop if you can. So if you have a glass tabletop, that's very reflective. Get like a rubber mat, a nice little rubber mat, and that'll help reduce the reflections. So now the microphone is strictly hearing mostly audio reflections from your voice and maybe what's behind it, because odds are you have to have an LCD computer screen, so we're not going to make that, you know, network. But if you minimize the other surfaces, now you've created a much cleaner sound. And then you can also turn the gain up on the microphone. You can do things. You don't have all the room noise coming in your way. So that helped to understand things.
Very cool. Very cool. I think we're at the end of the show.
Is it that time?
It is that time.
Next show coming up?
Another show coming up.
Oh, yes, that's right. Was it Mattman?
No. Mattman.
Yes, excellent. Live in studio today?
Absolutely.
Excellent. That's the way to do it. All right, I think you have to get a mat in that studio and start doing some live demonstrations.
I don't know if that'll work.
Ah, come on. Well, you know what? You can do that other area that you cordoned off. Just roll up the carpet, that's all.
That's it. That's what I'm going to do.
All right. Well, this is going to be the conclusion of our great episode to 202. Wow, that's wild. Of This Week in Radio Technology, I'm Chris Tobin, along with Andrew Zarian, who's our producer, board operator, and gracious host of the GFQ network. Kirk Harnack had to leave early. He's hopping a flight to Haiti. He's also gotten his shots, those of you who may be concerned. He's feeling good about it. Of course, once you take those shots for hepatitis and other things, you're never the same for 24 hours. But then again, that's just Kirk. Anyway, that's where we're at. And we're going to be on our way. And for now, Matt Men comes up after us. Well, that's for this one. I shouldn't say that now. This concludes episode 202. This Week in Radio Tech. Goodbye.